thing I did notice, that if somebody had come and they had been on the other side of the room and they had done that minor third, and did it with my moaning, then it would have had that comforting feeling, and it would have been supporting my breath at the time. So this goes hand in hand with what you've just been talking about.
Yeah, and how wonderful to have a tool like an instrument there where you can, or even with the voice, you know, with that instrument, to if you don't have one around. I think that it's the sharing of these stories, and again, there's sort of an instinct that is partly at work here, but I think it when this is validated in a variety of hospice settings, especially with situations where there is extreme pain and agony. I mean, I think sometimes those are the most difficult cases where, you know, someone is just really out of control, or they seem like they can't be reached in any kind of a rational way. To trust that vibration and sound is heard at a level. And maybe I'll take this as an opportunity to go to another little teaching here that maybe is helpful. In our Anamkara work, we draw a great deal off of the Celtic tradition. And so when I talk about moving to another level, this is one of the ingenious traditions that is, had a world view, a kind of a cosmology of the world that was very different than anything that we have, I think, around in the modern era. We tend to think of things in terms of matter versus spirit, in dualities. And in this ingenious Celtic worldview, which is probably actually a lot like the worldview found in many native or aboriginal cultures around the world, instead of matter versus spirit, they'll talk about a triple sort of concentric worldview. If you can kind of imagine three circles within each other. And the outer circle is the world of the senses, the world of the body, the world of that most of us are acquainted with, which for the dying person is beginning to dissolve. It's beginning to melt away. And then we often talk about, well, maybe there's something on the other side. And if there is, call it what you will, the world of spirit, the world of heaven, whatever, then I guess once the person stops breathing, they go there, whatever that is. But the Celtic instinct was that there was a middle world between the two. And I love this. They call it the world of Altar. It's spelled like altar, A-L-T-A-R, but it's got an extra L in it, A-L-L-T-A-R. And many of the practices from this tradition are about mediating between the outer world of the senses, when that's dissipating, and the other world, if you will, the world of the greater, the world of spirit, through intermediary practices. And one of the favorite practices in that altar world was the practice of sound, the practice of chant, the practice particularly of repetitious sounds, like Tina was referring to, not so much a melodic song or hymn, but deep, deep notes and sounds that they believed were resonating with the larger world of spirit. They would talk about this was the world of the intermediaries, the shining ones, the angels, the saints, the relatives who have gone to the other side. That in that place, it's kind of a thin place, a veiled place where it's kind of parting, if we can help provide a portal into that middle world, then instead of that person taking this journey alone, which is frightening, you know, the thought of leaving behind everything that you know and going into the unknown naturally is going to evoke fear in a lot of people. But the middle world is a place of mystery, of metaphor, where music can work very, very powerfully, sound and resonance. And I can create a container, an environment in that place where the outer world concerns of the body, and even some of the pain body, can begin to dissipate a bit because I begin to enter into this larger ocean, this larger pool of sound and of mystery. And if someone is willing to go there with me, what the Anamkara tradition is about, the soul friend tradition, is I don't just sort of stand there and point my finger and say, you go there. But in this tradition, who would be the one who would be willing, literally in their spirit, to travel with me to that middle world so that I'm not alone there? And once I get there, this is like the near-death experience reports that we often hear, instead of it being frightening for many people, they wouldn't want to come back. There's a sense of, oh, there must be more of this. And then there's a willingness to finally let go of the outer world and to release and to do that peacefully. So it's kind of broad and philosophical, but a lot of the tools that we would offer in the Sacred Art of Living and Dying tradition and the Anamkara Project would be about how I can journey with a person and be with them in that environment, in that atmosphere, where the outer world concerns begin to fade. And so I'll just kind of leave that thought there. But it was one of the little teachings I wanted to bring up today, because I think music is really one of the wonderful tools that can get you there faster than anything else. You know, you walk into a room with dead sound, or you hear this beautiful sound, and instantly the environment creates a peacefulness that helps your body and soul relax.
Wonderful, Richard.
Yeah, okay. So there's one other little piece I was hoping I could get to, and then maybe we can even have time for some questions. And I had asked Tina this morning if she would send to everybody a copy of our spiritual health assessment form, and I just want to refer to that a bit here because it is a concrete tool. And again, I think it might dovetail with some of what we've been talking about here. And if you see that form, and by the way, if you for some reason you didn't get it, you can go to our website at Sacred Art of Living Center. I'll give that to you at the end, and you can download that form from there. And it's there in about a dozen different languages, so you can use it however you'd like. We're happy to get this form out there and being used. But it's really the essence of our work for many years here at the center to try to put some language around spiritual suffering. The term is so broad and so vague sometimes. We sort of have an instinct that there is such a thing, but what does it look like and how would I respond to it if I saw it? And so this came out of an effort to look at those great wisdom traditions of living and dying and to sort of sum up in four different categories the most common experiences of soul pain, if you will, that any person, regardless of where in the world they are, if they're in soul pain, it's going to be in one of these areas, is what we're proposing. In other words, they may be having a crisis of meaning, to lose a sense of meaning and purpose in life. That's the first one. Is obviously painful. That's the kind of pain and suffering a person experiences, perhaps when they are going through a divorce or when they're losing a job or whatever it was that was important in life suddenly is wrenched from them, that obviously can be a source of tremendous spiritual suffering. The second category or element is that of forgiveness. And one of the original research projects that we were involved with was to network a number of hospitals and hospices around the country and to collect data about the patterns of forgiveness at the end of life that show up. And I mean, you wouldn't be surprised that this is the most common form of spiritual suffering. But what the research did point to was that that lack of forgiveness is far more frequently experienced in terms of forgiveness of self, the inability to do that, rather than the inability to forgive another. And so with each of these areas of spiritual suffering, what we wanted to do was create some tools that if you recognize that form of suffering could be a remedy or relief. I mean, I think the story that Tina brought us, the case study there, was a woman who was looking for some kind of absolution and how they represented that. And that would be a common kind of a spiritual pain at the end of life. So what would you do if a person didn't have a spiritual tradition or a cultural tradition where someone comes in to be the absolver at the end of life? How could I support someone in that? Third dimension of spiritual pain is relatedness. That very, very often broken relationship, and this is different than forgiveness. These are relationships that, for one reason or another, they were important to me at one point in life, and now they are elusive. Now they seem out of reach. It can be a relationship not just with a person, but with a role. It can be the pain of losing your identity because you can no longer function in a certain kind of job or profession, or perhaps a parent experiences this when the last children leave the home and they don't have that role or identity anymore, which in the past has given them great comfort. So that can be a source of suffering. And then the fourth and the final form of spiritual pain or suffering, which the ancients called the most drastic or extreme, I would call it the terminal illness of the soul, is hopelessness. So if there really is a sense that this situation is hopeless, it's extreme, it can never get any better, there's absolutely no possibility of light or remedy, that dark night of the soul experience, of course, well, it can lead to suicidal ideation, or it can lead just to extreme depression and spiritual suffering. So recognizing which of the four areas a person may be experiencing at the end of life, and discovering those areas, I would never give, obviously, a health assessment tool like this to somebody who is in the last days of life. That would be not useful. But sometimes with conversation with family members, sometimes with the team who's working in a particular case, there could be an insight into where the spiritual suffering is. And then to match that with the right tool is really the essence of our work at Sacred Art of Living Center. And I think, again, it's fascinating when we also study the possibility that there would be different modes of music, the mode or mood of music that might match a person's soul. This would be one real specific example. In India, I was summer before last, I spent about a month over there in a number of hospices in India, and I was curious about their ancient Vedic practices at the end of life. And I found that, of course, that the use of music was very, very essential. And there would be someone there in the hospice by the dying person who would be watching the breath and watching the physiological changes in a person. And then that person would, in a way, like an orchestrator or conductor, invite a different kind of chant, a different kind of sound that they believed was a kind of anointing, like a balm for the soul for a person who was in that particular stage of the transition. And I thought this is, again, something that we've often lost touch with in the West. We might think that we should come in with a one-size-fits-all model, but I know that your work in music therapy realizes that what's so important is to study the individual situation in person and to really observe the physical so that you can adapt the sound appropriately to that person's situation. But the other thing in India that I learned that I came to appreciate, which I think, again, was picked up in the medieval monastic hospices of Europe, was that the first rule, if you will, of the person who was tending to the dying was not to try to move that person away from where their emotional struggle was. In other words, you could think, well, gosh, if a person is sad, I'll bring in happy. It was instead, of course, to match the person exactly with the mood where they were at, even though that might seem depressing to do so. But to be with a person, you know, it's like when you're suffering, the last thing you want to do is come have someone come by and just say, oh, there now, everything's going to be fine. And well, no, it's not going to be fine. I just want someone to hear my grief, my pain, my suffering, to be with me in that place. And that music can provide that, that the right mode, which, you know, Tina beautifully walks you through those and helps you understand the history of those and people, when you experience those and can offer those and can match those to what you're observing in a patient's experience, then that person, without your manipulating it, we don't go in to fix anything, you provided an environment of solidarity with that person, and you begin to notice that very often that person's situation shifts. Their breathing moves from the upper chest to the belly, because instead of being so anxious, the matched mood is a place of potential solace and comfort. I'm oversimplifying it, but that was definitely an experience that that I saw in India. And when I visited with people about those Vedic traditions in the hospices in ancient India, where so many of our cultures go back to that experience, I realized, wow, this tradition, this instinct has been around for 5,000 years at least. We've known how to do this, and how wonderful to be alive today when we see an interest in study and all of that being resurrected or revisited.
Right. You know, Richard, one of the things that I'm thinking here is you saw that happen in India. And, of course, in India they have a whole different set of modes and ragas that they play for music. And so just a point to bring home to the students is that not only are we matching the person's resonance and their breathing tempo, and it's always a act of matching, but one of the important things is the type of music that they would have listened to. So if you're playing for somebody from an Asian culture, there are modes that fit into the Asian music. If you're playing somebody for somebody who is from a Middle Eastern culture, then there are modes of music that are familiar to them. I think it's really important for people to feel that sense of comfort of the sounds that they've listened to throughout their lives, as well as having that tempo and the musical elements. When we get to our experiential module, when we meet, and you're working with the Celtic Circle of Music, you'll see how we're working with that whole sense of relaxation, going into a minor mode and then coming up to something lighter. But that may be done within different types of modes of music depending on the person that we're working with. So being able to have familiarity is really important in the work.
And just exactly, in the Celtic tradition, you know, there's sort of dark modes and light modes. And part of the job of the Anamkara is to see that if a person's stuck with too much of something, it would be like taking a person's blood work and recognizing that there are trace minerals missing. And therefore, of course, we would want to bring the body back into greater balance by supplement or whatever it might be. They would say, use the same kind of process with music and with sound. And so they would first begin by matching the person, as you say. But then the Anamkara, again, because they've been around in that tradition, you'd have to be sort of an apprentice for 20 years. So you'd be hanging out, watching the master do this, Master Anamkara. You would also know when enough is enough and when it would be time to introduce gently the light mode to begin to counterbalance the dark, because a person can get stuck in a place. So it is a subtle art, absolutely, you know, and it's a body, mind, spirit art, and it's an art, not a science. It takes, you couldn't come in with a computer and do this, you know. It really does take, in addition to the things that we can quantify scientifically about a person's breath and so forth, there's also an instinctive, intuitive dimension to this work. And I think probably the shamanistic traditions are the ones who have kept that alive better than any other, because you might come with the right chant and so forth, but you're also using that sort of other sense, the sixth sense, if you will, the soul senses, to determine, you know, in a non-rational way what else might be helpful to that person. And, you know, we do this all the time. Again, this can sound so frightening, like, well, who am I to be an intuitive? But we do it all the time. I think part of the practice and the training, Carolyn Mace's work, I just really, really respect around this. She's I don't know if any of her works are assigned in your readings, Tina, but just on for your own edification, if you're going to go into this work and you're going to be hanging out with pain and suffering, it's good to know that you can trust your instincts, that they're probably more infallible than anything else. You learn all the science, that's great, and then you come into a situation and everyone is unique, and your own soul sense sort of kicks in, and you begin to trust that more.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I've been going on here quite a bit, and I'm noticing where we're at with the time. We're at about 6:15. And I want to make sure that there's some space for questions or responses. And so why don't I just kind of start? Tina, will you help kind of feel that? Or
yes, I think this is a good time. We had other people sign on after we had our introductions. So welcome to all of you who signed on afterwards. Would anybody like to make a comment or ask a question at this point? And right now I'm curious because Beatrice Rose actually has a 4 pushed, and I don't know if she did that by mistake, but let me just check in with Beatrice and find out. Beatrice, did you have a question or a comment?
I guess I did push it by mistake, Tina, but actually I did have a thought because, you know, I'd asked a question at the beginning, and Richard's discussion was really helpful in clarifying and kind of gave me some aha thoughts about it. And in the situation that I described, one thing that had been puzzling to me about how to respond was as the patient was very vocal and moaning, and his wife was on the bed with him, and she was going, you know, shh, it's okay, shh, it's okay, shh. And so you have not only the patient and what's happening to them and supporting them, but then, you know, what's going on around them. And I guess in my mind I was thinking, oh, you know, don't shush him. but musically we can address that, which is what I attempted to do, you know.
So, 2 things, Beatrice. First of all, how did you work with that musically? And second of all, can you reiterate the question that you had for Richard earlier so that we know what you were referring to?
Right. The question I have for Richard was, in this instance, I was assessing that this person must have spiritual pain because of how frightened he looked. Of course, I couldn't converse with him. So how to address that spiritual pain, I'm assessing just by observing. And, of course, it's not a time where there can be conversation. And so as Richard just talked about that and how we can use music, that was really affirming to me in how I did address it, by listening for his tone and by matching what was going on with him, and even sometimes using just my voice alone. And I played for a long time, over an hour and a half, and I did. And he died a few hours after that. So I did notice greater ease by the time I went, but it took quite a while. And
mm-hmm.
So it was, you know, being witness to struggle, where my imagining was that this person was was having difficulty letting go due to spiritual pain, or as Richard mentioned, just frightening because you're having a hard time breathing and, you know, you're probably afraid of dying, and how we can support that and help someone let go. I wish he could have let go right while I was there, you know, and I didn't know how it went after I left, but just that it was just a few more hours.
Well, that, thank you, Peter. That's a really, I'm glad you came back to that, and I wanted to, I had made a note of your question earlier on, and I can link this actually with the question that someone else had asked about the Afro-Iberian tradition and what kinds of tools they used, because this is where they really were experts. To put it simply, you know, very often we can understandably feel, especially if there's family members present, that our job or our role is to fix suffering. You know, that success, what would success look like in this situation? Well, that a person was struggling and suffering, and then I would come in, you know, and we have to admit, you know, it would just be one.